Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good Monday afternoon. It's the show on 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein. In Valley traffic at this hour, a few accidents to let you know about. 51 northbound at Cactus, the on-ramp is blocked by that collision. Also an accident I-10 eastbound at the 101. Also a collision I-10 westbound at the Baseline Road on-ramp. That, too, is blocking that ramp. Valley weather for tonight looks like our first dose of monsoon weather. It'll be partly cloudy tonight with about a 20% chance for rain. Then for tomorrow, partly cloudy with a slight chance of afternoon rain and a high of 107. Pro-choice advocates in Texas celebrated today's Supreme Court decision to strike down some of the state's strict regulation on abortion providers. KJZZ's Monica Ortiz-Uribe reports on the ruling's impact along the border.
Getting an abortion after 2012 became a lot harder for Texas women. Two out of three clinics that serve the border region shut down, unable to comply with the state's strict new regulations. One of those clinics was Reproductive Services in El Paso. Jerry Laster runs the clinic.
Local women had to go to New Mexico, Dallas, San Antonio, Austin, and we're still seeing women from West Texas because there are no services there.
The clinics were able to reopen after the Supreme Court issued an injunction last year. Today's Supreme Court ruling means they can stay open. Laster said her clinic provided 1,600 abortions in 2012. Texas border clinics also serve women from Mexico, where abortion is mostly illegal. Monica Ortiz-Uribe, KJZZ News.
The state of Arizona has eliminated its use of the sedative midazolam as one of the drugs it relies on in carrying out executions. Lawyers for the state said in a court filing Friday its current supply of midazolam expired on May 31st, and Arizona's sources of the drug have dried up because of pressure from opponents of the death penalty. Michael Kiefer has covered the story extensively for the Arizona Republic and AZ Central and joins me. Mike, how did we reach this stage?
This has been going on with all of the drugs used for execution. Sodium thiopental became unavailable. They moved to pentobarbital. The pharmaceutical companies did not want to be associated with their drugs, which they made to save lives, being used to kill people. And midazolam was the same. It was the same way. There were two different things going on with midazolam. One was the question about its efficacy. There were some fabulously or horribly flawed executions in Oklahoma, Ohio, and here in Arizona using the drug midazolam. The question was, even in front of the U.S. Supreme Court last year, was does it sufficiently mask the pain of the other drugs that follow it? The U.S. Supreme Court said, well, we think it meets all the criteria, but the district court judge here in Phoenix said, well, he thought that there might be some more evidence, there might be some more studies, and he was going to make the Department of Corrections and the state litigate all of those questions. But at the same time, it became unavailable, and the state could no longer obtain it, so they are asking that the case become moot. They've said they're not going to use it for ongoing, further future executions.
Well, so does this essentially, at least for a while, put the death penalty on hold in Arizona, or are there ways around this?
Well, it puts it on hold. The last year, Arizona and three other states tried to import thiopental, the original drug, from India. All of the shipments were either stopped before they were shipped, or in the case of Arizona, it was stopped at the airport because the FDA will not allow it in as an unapproved drug. There was a court decision in Washington, D.C. saying that you cannot import it. That is something they're litigating. The other issue is if the judge dismisses the case as moot, given the director of the Department of Corrections, who has ultimate discretion in these things, or he has very much discretion, he could decide, well, here's this new drug, and we could start all over again. So we aren't done. And of course, if all that fails, then you know, they you know, could try to move forward to a different type of execution. I don't think this is going to end capital punishment in the state of Arizona. The thing is that if you were to try to instate another form of capital punishment, such as the firing squad, then that's going to require a change in the state constitution. So that has to go out to the voters in general.
Michael Kiefer of the Arizona Republic and AZ Central. Primary results from the AZ merit test were released today, and overall student performance improved slightly this year. KJZZ's Carrie Young has taken a closer look at some of the data and joins me now. So, Carrie, from 2015 to 2016, what are the most significant overall numbers you're seeing?
Overall, well, you had it right, Steve. We did see some slight improvement. Now, what that means was we see more kids receiving passing scores in both the language arts and the mathematics section of the AZ merit test, which is our standardized test in this state.
So, Carrie, let's dig in more deeply. In general, we have those numbers, but as far as a grade-by-grade basis, what were you seeing?
Like I said, more students are passing, but when you take a closer look at the numbers, you're seeing that it's still less than 50% of students that are receiving passing scores on this. Some are looking at this as bad news. However, Erin Hart, she's the chief operating officer at Expect More Arizona. She said they are looking at this more of as an incremental gain, that it's a good thing that we still have a lot more work to do.
We know that if we can rally around as a community to support our teachers and our students, that we know we can help move our students over time to be proficient or highly proficient.
Taking a closer look at some of the math scores, too, like I said, most of those were increases, but eighth grade, that was a significant decrease we saw there. Now, officials say there is a reason behind that. This was the first year they did not double test eighth graders, which means if eighth graders are taking a math course that is higher than their grade level, like algebra or geometry, they were not tested in both. So some of those higher scoring eighth graders, they were lumped in with other test scores. So that's why we saw that much of a drop compared to others.
All the high-performing eighth graders were included in last year's 2015 number. But in this year, in 2016, the number went down likely because the highest-performing eighth grade students were actually taking other assessments in other grades because they were in accelerated courses.
KJZZ's Carrie Young with today's results from the AZ Merit Test. Carrie, thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
The impact of so-called dark money has been increasing across the country as campaign donors have been able to keep themselves anonymous and the prevalence of independent expenditure groups has grown. A new report by the nonpartisan Brennan Center for Justice focuses on six states, including Arizona, and looks at dark money spending since the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling in Citizens United. Chi-Sun Lee is senior counsel in the Brennan Center's Democracy Program, and she joins me. Chi-Sun, in addition to dark money, the report looks at gray money. What is that?
Gray money is money spent by groups that should be considered transparent in that the law usually requires them to report who their donors are. But we found, looking into these organizations, that they would disclose as their donors other organizations that themselves get donations from people, and possibly further down the chain, more organizations that get donations. So technically, they've disclosed their immediate donors, but it doesn't tell the voters anything meaningful about where the money originally came from. Gray money in 2014, which is the most recent election cycle for which we had complete data, gray money accounted for nearly 60% of all outside spending. This is, you know, most people would think of as super PAC spending across the six states that we were able to examine.
So does gray money feel like a workaround then?
The data that we looked at can't tell us why donors and spenders behaved the way that they did. But what we did know, what we do know is looking at how spending and disclosure worked in 2006 compared to in 2014. This gray money phenomenon just became a much bigger portion of the pie. So we know that it's happening much more often, that super PACs are reporting other PACs rather than reporting where they directly got their money from. And we know by looking at specific examples where it's possible to look at gray money in action, you know, one thing is it's very difficult to find many, many examples because, you know, by its nature, a lot of this spending is secretive. But in California, that has really good disclosure laws and a very strong enforcement agency, they're often able to get to the bottom of certain instances where disclosure didn't work the way it ought to have.
One of the most striking numbers to me, which is also cited in the op-ed in the New York Times that you wrote, 76% of outside spending in the six states you looked at, including Arizona, was fully transparent. And then by 2014, just 29%. Can we draw the conclusion that it's not just those six states where that's happening, but in other states are seeing that same sort of trend, or is that hard to say because you just studied the six?
Well, we've given that question actually a lot of thought because looking at only six states at first seems like it's such a tiny piece of the country. What conclusions can we draw? But the states that we looked at happen to contain a fifth of the nation's population. So we think that they are more representative than just six states seems to be. And also, we fear that our findings are probably, they probably understate the secrecy problem because half the states don't even track election season advertising that mentions candidates without explicitly saying vote for so-and-so or kick so-and-so out of office. We know in half of the country, the secrecy problem is much, much worse. People simply don't know who is spending, let alone who is funding those ads.
Chi-Sun Lee is senior counsel in the Brennan Center's Democracy Program. She helped write their recent report on dark money and gray money. For an Arizona perspective, I'm joined by Tom Collins, executive director of the Citizens Clean Elections Commission. Tom, what does the Brennan Center report tell you about the power of so-called dark money in Arizona's elections?
This report deals with the 2014 election. And one of the things that's really interesting about that is that since 2014, the legislature has gone back twice now, working with the Secretary of State's office to further restrict the amount of information that campaign finance officials around the state might receive from these kinds of organizations. So, you know, so in 2014, we had the most expensive, least transparent election in state history. The remedy for that that was passed in 2015 and then expanded upon in 2016 is actually to make the laws clearer, but also make them more restrictive in terms of the amount of information that folks are going to get.
Tom, what does this element of gray money indicate to you?
Well, I think there's two or three different policy questions that voters and others who are interested in this issue are going to have to deal with at some point. One of them is, you know, what are the enforcement mechanisms you're going to put in place to get to the first level of information that you need? And right now in Arizona, you see a tremendous amount of pushback to prevent even that first level of enforcement and information being disclosed and publicized. The second order question of, you know, what is below the surface of in terms of money moving through the system, some of that information eventually comes to light through other filings that organizations may have to make with the Internal Revenue Service and others. But, you know, getting that on a timely basis is a challenge. Unfortunately, what you see happening in Arizona is the legitimate concern about getting at how these networks operate preempts the argument about whether or not we have good, solid enforcement procedures and laws in place on the front end. And so the troublesome problem of getting at the ultimate question of how these networks operate becomes an argument for inaction on the very basic need for voters to have information on a timely basis about who's trying to influence their vote in a particular election.
From the numbers we've seen, Donald Trump's campaign is not attracting many big donors yet, but some of those donors may put more effort into local and congressional elections. How closely will you be watching that in Arizona?
Decisions at the local level, in the legislature, in statewide offices, whatever they are far more important to what happens on the day-to-day life of voters many times than decisions made at the federal level. And so, obviously, a Senate race in a state like Arizona, because of the Trump factor, will be, you know,
potentially much more competitive than people would have anticipated, and that will result in its own creating its own atmosphere. But I think that, you know, the track record in Arizona is that from 2014, when we had a better legal regime than we now have, is that folks who have a lot riding on who gets one seat in the legislature, who gets one seat on the Corporation Commission, will, you know, spend money as they desire to, and they have the freedom to do that.
Tom Collins is executive director of Arizona's Citizens Clean Elections Commission. It's the show on 91.5. Thanks for listening this afternoon. I'm Steve Goldstein, along with the takeaways, John Hockenberry today.
A stern rebuke from the bench and a huge sigh of relief for healthcare providers for women in the states of Texas and Mississippi as the U.S. Supreme Court, by a 5-3 vote, ruled against a Texas law that tried to restrict abortion clinics with a so-called safety requirement that would have forced many clinics to close and left millions of women unable, practically speaking, to seek reproductive health care. The court said that the law in Texas that restricts doctors from performing abortions unless they have so-called hospital admitting privileges is unconstitutional, and they agreed with doctors who argued that the law did not seriously affect safety.
That is complete nonsense. So there is nothing about this law that improves safety related to abortions. Doctors love talking about safety. We have conferences. We do research. We love safety. If there was something that would actually improve safety related to abortion, we're all for it. And we're always working on things to make abortion safer, though it's hard to do because abortion is so safe as it is already.
That's Dr. Ann Davis, consulting medical director for Physicians for Reproductive Health. Ian Millhiser also spoke with us. He's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and author of Injustices, the Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted. He says the court was not fooled by the cleverness of the Texas law.
If, in fact, Texas had challenged Roe v. Wade directly, if they had said, like, we just don't think there should be a constitutional right to an abortion at all, you know, at least they would have been honest about what they were up to, and the court could have had a conversation about whether they want to keep in place this right that they recognized in 1973. What they're doing instead here is they're trying to be super cute.
You say cute, but does the court recognize the cuteness issue? I mean, is there sort of any legal issue here?
Well, so, I mean, at the oral argument, it was very clear that many of the justices knew exactly what Texas was up to because they grilled Texas's Solicitor General on how this law doesn't seem to have any actual health benefits. Notably, Justice Kennedy, who is the crucial swing vote in this case, also suggests that he thought that this law is an undue burden. But yeah, like to the cuteness issue, I mean, what they have done here, what Texas did here, is they looked at past precedents that said that abortion clinics can be regulated for safety. And like they should be regulated, just like any doctor is regulated to make sure that they engage in self-safe medical practices. And they said, let's pass a sham law. Let's pass a law that looks like it's a medical safety law. But as Dr. Davis noted, the admitting privileges provision really has nothing to do with medical safety. There's another provision that imposes very expensive architectural requirements on clinics, everything from the width of the halls to the width of the doorways to the angle that water is squirted out of water fountains in the clinic is regulated by this law. And, you know, first of all, I'm not sure that the squirting of water in your water fountain is going to do much to improve the safety of your abortions. But setting that aside, what most of these regulations are for is there are regulations that are typically imposed upon facilities that do major surgeries. And many abortion clinics don't do any surgeries at all. They only offer medication abortions where a woman is given a pill or a series of pills to take, and that's it. The problem with this law, and I think this might explain why Justice Kennedy looks like he may balk at it, is that it is an attempt to play a fast one on the courts, to say, if we dress something up, if we put enough wool on this wolf, will the court treat it as a sheep?
Is there precedent in the legal system for a process? And let's just say for the moment, everyone would agree that it's permissible under the First Amendment to have a debate over the right to choose and an abortion, although people have strong opinions about it. But is there precedent for that debate and that discussion to apparently have so many onerous implications for people in hospitals? Patients are affected by this going back and forth in various states. I just wonder if at a certain point, this debate itself is harmful to people with medical needs. Ian?
Well, I mean, I could think of two very recent precedents. That was the two lawsuits challenging the Affordable Care Act. I mean, these were cases that dealt with whether millions of people would have health insurance. You had hospitals that had changed their entire business plan because they were anticipating that the Affordable Care Act would be there, and it endangered their ability potentially to continue operating if the law suddenly went away. I mean, I discussed this, you know, in a tremendous amount of detail in my book, what would have happened to patients if this law had ceased to exist. So, I mean, it is certainly true that there is, I think, a rather unfortunate tendency by litigants to try to set health policy or challenge health policies they don't like in the courts, often without much concern for what this means for the patients involved.
Ian Millhiser is senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and author of Injustices, the Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted.
That's John Hockenberry from our partners at The Takeaway. When you get your ballot in the mail or consider it while you're in the voting booth, the most confusing category for most people includes judges. There's typically a long list of names that most of us are not familiar with. Do you randomly choose which judges deserve to be retained? Do you vote for or against all of them? Do you simply not vote on those? The Arizona Commission on Judicial Performance Review's job is to give voters some insight on those judges based on input from people who've dealt with them in court on issues from legal knowledge to courtesy. On Friday, the commission voted on how to rate judges on the 2016 ballot. Mike Helen of Tucson is the commission's chair. And Mike, after the commission has heard from the public, what do you do next?
We rate the judge basically on a scale of unsatisfactory, poor, average, above average, and excellent. If we get too many responses in the unsatisfactory and poor category, we send the judge a letter outlining the area of concern. It may be communications, it may be timely decision making, it may be bias, whatever the concern is among the respondents to our survey. And we offer the judge an opportunity to come in and visit with us and discuss that particular area of concern. This past cycle, my recollection is we sent 12 letters to judges. Seven of them actually came in.
And how many judges are going to be on the ballot this time around? And could you share with us how many got the thumbs up and how many not quite as much?
My recollection is there are 70 judges on the ballot. But of the total, the commission voted not to retain two judges. Everybody else they voted to retain.
Mike, in your heart of hearts, in an ideal world, what would voters use this information for? When it comes down to getting the pamphlet, they look at the work the commission has done. What do you want voters to take from that?
I believe the merit system in Arizona works best if the voters accept the commission's judgments about judges. One thing we do not do is rate a judge based on any particular decision. Our focus is on the process. Generally speaking, is this judge efficient? Does this judge communicate well? Does this judge have sufficient legal knowledge to be an effective judge? The one thing that is extremely important to this commission, over and above everything else, is how does the judge treat people in the courtroom? If we find that a judge fails in that area, that is where the commission is most likely to recommend to the voters that judge not be retained. That happened 2 years ago when Judge Ben Norris was voted not to be retained by the commission and actually voted out of office by the voters of Maricopa County.
Mike Helen is chair of the Arizona Commission on Judicial Performance Review. As we continue our celebration of the working life, we're looking at the people who do the jobs you sometimes don't see or don't think about. We're thinking about the jobs around Metro Phoenix that might not be what you expect. Maybe you get a copy of the New York Times or the Republic every morning in your driveway, and you count on it to appear there every day. Well, the process starts at 11 p.m. in several paper assembly warehouses around the valley. Today we step into the late night, early morning delivery job.
My name's Kathy Cardenas, and I'm a carrier with the Arizona Republic. When I come in, first thing, the papers are on our tables to pre-assemble. There's two parts. So we have our community, which I deliver in Mesa, and then we have the preview. So we have to insert them before the heads get here, which is all the updated news. They should be here by 1:12. And you can tell we don't have like air conditioning in here. There's swamp coolers. So right now it's okay, but normally by the time we get out of here, we're soaked. The papers just got here. So this is the last step. I'm just holding the papers. I'll bag them. And then the next step will be loading and then going and delivering the papers. Probably be about close to 3 o'clock, we'll get out of here. We're just like mail carriers. No matter if it rains, it's hot, we still have to throw the paper. When we bag everything, we have to have them color coordinated. So the red is for Wall Street. We have green for the USA, blue for the New Yorks. The Republic is in clear bags. On Sunday, I have 300. During the week, it goes down because most of my customers just want the weekend paper. I can't throw my paper out of the passenger door. I have to throw it over. The papers are my friend. They go in the front. So they're easy to reach. I don't know, it just soothes my mind when I'm by myself and throwing the papers. And you're just, you know, out here just delivering your papers and you just do what you gotta do.
That's Kathy Cardenas Ruiz delivering papers in Gilbert. It's almost time for the next episode of The Quiz Show. That's when we bring back our resident quizmaster and Jeopardy! Tournament of Champions winner, Leszek Pawlowicz. He'll face off against a KJZZ staff member in a game of trivia, but you can get in on the action too. Just solve this riddle. Throw away the outside and cook the inside. Then eat the outside and throw away the inside. What is it? When you have the answer, email us at theshow@kjzz.org. We'll randomly draw two names from the correct answers, and either Leszek or one of our KJZZ newsroom staffers will play on your behalf. If your player wins, you'll win a special KJZZ item. It's The Show on 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein. Forensic pathologists, you know, the docs who do autopsies, are in high demand these days. Nationwide, there are twice as many open jobs as there are people to do the work. That means attracting and keeping these physicians can be a challenge, an issue Maricopa County is currently trying to tackle. In the first of a four-part series we're calling The Business of Dying, KJZZ's Kerry Young reports.
A typical day at the Maricopa County Medical Examiner's Office begins with an all-staff meeting to review the morning's caseload. For Dr. Bridget Utenier, it's going to be a busy day.
I have a variety of cases today. I have a gentleman who was shot multiple times by another outside of his residence, so it's a likely homicide.
Utenier dons her protective clothing and face mask. Her day includes multiple homicides, so she swapped one of her cases with another doctor. He'll be doing some simpler examinations.
Anytime we have a number of homicides in a day, that can increase the complexity of the day.
Utenier is one of 10 forensic pathologists working full-time here, but 10 doctors for the nearly 5,000 death investigations that pass through the office means long days and creative scheduling.
With the economy downturn, we lost three of those positions, and we've been straddling 8 to 10 physicians for the last 5 years.
Dr. Jeff Johnson is Maricopa County's chief medical examiner. He says keeping up with the work and staying fully staffed is important. The reports his office generates impact a lot of people, from homicide investigators and public health officials to the deceased's loved ones.
It's not that any individual exam takes us any longer, it's just that there's too many of them. So we still try to prioritize based on the best interest of the public.
Johnson insists these staffing challenges haven't impacted the quality of the autopsy reports his office releases. What suffers is turnaround time, and Maricopa County isn't alone.
The estimate is that we're at about 50% of the forensic pathologists needed to adequately supply the demand in this country.
David Fowler is with the National Association of Medical Examiners. Despite what you may see on TV glamorizing the profession,
we're finished rendering the laser scan of the Great Pumpkin surface.
He explains there are typically just 40 physicians a year that graduate with the right credentials. There are several reasons behind this imbalance, but a lot of it boils down to money. On average, forensic pathologists are paid about two-thirds of what a general pathologist makes. So if you're going to do this job, you've got to be passionate about it. But if that is you, you're in high demand.
Everybody's going to be forced to try and protect their staff from being poached by another office. And if you don't do that, you're going to lose staff. The workload goes up. You end up with a very rapid downward spiral.
So what's a medical examiner's office to do to stay on top of things? Well, that's a question officials in Maricopa County are taking very seriously.
And then the medical examiner, the next chart you see some statistics regarding their caseload information. The medical examiner.
In a recent budget meeting, county supervisors approved $1.5 million in additional funding for the ME office for the coming year so they can better compete for employees. Included is an adjustment to maintain industry competitive salaries. And while that's still less than the average hospital pathologist, officials hope a $10,000 moving package, 6 weeks of paid vacation, and a lower caseload threshold might convince someone to come here rather than another major city. As for Dr. Jeff Johnson at the Maricopa County Medical Examiner's Office, he's confident this will help his office in the short term. But
it's a stress on the office, and it's continued to be a stress on the office.
In the end, he says, the medical profession as a whole needs to rethink training practices and expose students to forensic pathology earlier in their med school experience. Hopefully then, he adds, more people will consider a glamorous career in forensics. Carrie Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
From time to time on the show, we'll hear from commentators who have a unique perspective and are passionate about their topic.
We won't be able to say we didn't see it coming. The behavior of candidate Trump indicates what a President Trump might do. That would seem to include his dismantling of parts of our First Amendment, speech and press freedom.
Here's commentator Joseph Russomano.
Donald Trump's war with the news media continues. At a recent news conference, Trump blasted reporters, including describing some of those present as dishonest, and singling out one journalist as a sleaze. It was another Trump tantrum, this one over news reports, that painted a less than positive portrait of him. Yes, some reports make him look very bad. Sometimes the truth does that. But there's the rub. The American brand of speech and press freedom reveres the truth. Our law even allows for minor falsity in limited circumstances in an effort to achieve uninhibited, robust, and wide-open debate on matters of public concern. It's done with the hope that the truth will ultimately emerge. The First Amendment allows for, even encourages, the kind of reporting that challenges authority in the name of the people. And it protects the people in their right to discuss and debate various viewpoints, in the process becoming an informed electorate armed with the power of the vote. The government can't interfere. But Trump wants to change that. Earlier this year, he announced his desire to alter our libel laws so that the publishers of reports he finds unacceptable can be successfully sued. No president can do that. That would require an about-face by the U.S. Supreme Court, a court that, even in its most conservative eras, tends to be First Amendment friendly. The ability to criticize government and public officials, including political candidates, is a cornerstone of this democratic society. The ability of the press and citizens to hold those in power accountable is precisely what the Founding Fathers had in mind. And yet, even some of them went astray. With the ink barely dry on the Bill of Rights, a president who thought he knew better, John Adams, and his Federalist compatriots in Congress passed the Sedition Act of 1798, designed to consolidate executive authority, the new law criminalized criticism of the administration and Congress. Several violators were arrested and successfully prosecuted, including newspaper publishers who had dared to print the truth. Thomas Jefferson and James Madison led the way in explaining how the dangerous law subverted the First Amendment and its meaning. Public sentiment eventually turned. The Federalists were voted out of office, and the party disintegrated. The first step toward discerning the central meaning of the First Amendment had been taken. Like Trump today, Adams and the Federalists wanted a subservient press. In the late 18th century, it took the likes of Jefferson and Madison to confront tyranny. Who is the Jefferson or Madison to confront this 21st century version?
Joseph Russomanno is an associate professor in ASU's Cronkite School of Journalism and Mass Communication and a faculty affiliate at the O'Connor College of Law. He's a First Amendment and media law expert. Business in Tempe has seen its ups and downs, like most cities, and there have been efforts to rebrand. Some of that has centered on the downtown area and Mill Avenue, and how many businesses should be local and how many should be national. Marianne Miller's been at the center of those discussions for about two decades. She's been part of the leadership of the Tempe Chamber of Commerce for 21 years and its president and CEO since 1999. Miller recently announced she'd be leaving the job at the end of August, and she joins me. Marianne, where has Tempe's economic and business progress come from?
First of all, I think that the university, which has always had a huge impact in Tempe, continues to help that community grow. And then you've got the synergies of the students, which really helps Tempe. You know, additionally, Tempe, which has always been progressive, being on the forefront of mass transit has been huge. You know, if Tempe had not passed that transit tax back in 96, that the chamber ran that election, we wouldn't be where we are today with extensions into Mason, into Glendale, into South Phoenix, and the streetcar. That's very exciting. The lake, to see the difference in the lake. When you consider that Tempe is actually landlocked and centralized, instead of that central city flight that you might have, people are drawn here.
You're dealing with a greater valley community. Mm-hmm. And yes, there is collaboration, of course, there's cooperation, but there also is a level of competition. I mean, Tempe wants to get certain businesses, maybe in competition with Phoenix, with Chandler, whatever it may be. As someone who's been in a position with the chamber where you're talking up the virtues of Tempe, but you're also, I imagine, a fan of the general valley instead. Where does the balance come in of competition with cooperation for you?
I think, you know, first of all, we would love for things to happen in Tempe. But realizing that if it doesn't happen in Tempe, if it happens in Scottsdale or in Phoenix or in Chandler or in Mesa or, frankly, even in Glendale, it will impact Tempe. People drive cross town. People will go to places that they find interesting. Tempe is a net importer of jobs, so we get so many more people in to shop and to play and to eat than live here. So all of that is good for us. So I think in this community, it's very unusual, and it's hard to explain to people from outside because you've got the big dog, you've got Phoenix, but they're not this huge, overpowering entity with everybody else just, you know, yapping at their heels. You've got, you know, Mesa, which is bigger than St. Louis. You've got Buckeye, which is bigger than Phoenix in area. You've got Tempe as an importer of jobs. So we all have our strengths. So we work together much better than so many other metro areas that I've been with.
What do you think the flavor of Tempe should be from a business standpoint?
I think Tempe, and I think any community, really needs a mixture. It needs the national companies because it needs that stability. It needs the jobs that they create. It needs the entrepreneurs, the small businesses, the small restaurants to provide a little bit of flavor, something different, something for something to break up the sameness.
There's going to be some sort of biosciences campus near the Tempe Center for the Arts. Mm-hmm. We can all see the huge State Farm buildings if we're driving on the Red Mountain Freeway, the 202. We see all these things happening. Why do you think that is? What are some of the factors that are making Tempe even more attractive now at this point?
Well, I think, first of all, with the end of the recession, or most of the recession, that resurgence has come back, and it's always sort of been there underneath the surface. So the things that have always made Tempe attractive now has just brought them to the fores as people put them together. Certainly the connectivity to the rest of the valley and to the world. I mean, we're very close to the airport. That's extremely helpful to the business community. The mass transit, the options, that's really what it's about, is the options.
Looking at the Tempe business climate, is there one thing looking forward next 1 to 3 years that you are think this really puts Tempe in a great position? And is there one thing you feel like this could be a significant challenge going forward if we don't make a change in this direction or other?
No, I think that we are on a good course in Tempe. There will always be discussions and disagreements over height in certain places, over density, over whether a particular facade should look like this versus that. But I think that Tempe is well positioned to move forward in the next several years. I think probably the biggest impact of things that will happen are the development of the ASU Facilities District and what occurs there, and then the construction of the streetcar.
Mary Ann Miller, the outgoing president and CEO of the Tempe Chamber of Commerce. Last Friday on the show, we spoke with Fernanda Santos of the New York Times about a piece she'd written about the increased hipness of downtown Phoenix.
There's such low expectation by people who come from other parts to come here that when they get here, they get really surprised. And it's kind of, you know, it may sound kind of mean to say that, but it's not. It's actually a really great thing.
To find out whether that's also being felt by longtime Arizonans, I'm joined by attorney Grady Gamage, a native. Grady, what's caused this dramatic shift in reality and perception?
I think the ASU downtown campus is the single biggest change. I tell people I've been working in downtown Phoenix since 1967. I was in high school when I started working downtown. And all the stuff that the city tried and have done over the years, big hotels, convention centers, sports facilities, none of those made as much difference as the ASU downtown campus did, because it put people on the street in the daytime. And not just migrating in to go to an event and then leaving. And the fact that that happened right as light rail came online created a kind of synergy that finally began to make a real difference in downtown.
Is there a real evolution happening there, and how bumpy can that evolution be?
Well, there is an evolution happening, but it's got a ways to go yet. I mean, downtown has finally gotten the beginning of a critical mass. And I'm not sure it quite is a critical mass yet, but you can go downtown now and feel as though you're in the downtown of a major city. It's still not a place where it's sort of your residual choice for something to do. There's nothing to do on the weekend. Hey, let's go downtown. But it's getting close. And, you know, between some of the restaurants and attractions that are down there, if they were just a little closer together, part of the problem is there's a great restaurant over there, there's a great bar over there, and there are three empty parking lots in between still. It's going to take a while to sort of fill that in.
Well, how much does income play into all this, Grady, especially as retail changes and that a lot of downtown depends on people who will go out frequently? You have to get young people with jobs, and in some cases pretty high-paying jobs, to be able to manage a lifestyle like that. Is Phoenix prepared for that?
So one of the dilemmas, and Fernanda's piece in the New York Times talked about this some, is you need young people with relatively high-paying jobs that are also proximate to the places where they want to hang out. And so we're slowly building both of those in the downtown, but we still don't have a huge number of sort of Richard Florida creative class type jobs in the downtown area. There are probably more places to hang out than there are jobs at the moment in terms of the ratio between the two. One of the dilemmas for getting those kinds of cool jobs in downtown Phoenix is we don't have enough old buildings. The incubator for small businesses, high-tech startups, and so on in cities has tended to be old buildings where you can have lower rents than you do in brand new buildings.
Grady, let's go to the mostly accepted premise that downtown Phoenix has made great strides When we look at the cities that a lot of people would think of Phoenix competing with, maybe it's Denver, maybe it's Austin, maybe it's that's a little smaller, but maybe San Diego, these sorts of places. Is Phoenix in catch-up mode, and are we catching up fast enough, or do we, when it comes to competing with other cities, is there another way to measure that?
Well, we are in catch-up mode. Those cities are all ahead of us, and part of the reason is those cities had major downtown cores long before we did. I mean, if you think about the Gaslamp District in San Diego or Lodo in Denver, there were a large number of buildings from the early part of the 20th century up through the pre-World War II environment that were built and were still standing when those downtowns really began to revitalize. We just simply didn't have as big a downtown in 1950 as San Diego did, or as Denver did, or as San Antonio, for that matter, did. I think that means we're going to be lagging behind those older cities for a long time.
Attorney and Valley native Grady Gamage. So what happens when the New York Times does say nice things about a place? Steve Corman of ASU's Center for Strategic Communications says it's about framing a narrative.
Framing means basically using words, phrases, and other sort of rhetorical devices to encourage one interpretation of a set of facts and discourage others. So, for example, it's a fact that if you die and you have over a certain amount of assets, then those assets will be taxed by the government. Now, that was always called an estate tax. And calling that, you know, makes people think of estates, and it encourages the interpretation that it's applied to rich people with a lot of excess wealth. But back in the 1990s, conservatives started calling it a death tax to encourage the interpretation that it's an example of out-of-control government taxing you even in the grave. So that's the same set of facts, but two different interpretations to the framing. And it has, you know, a big effect on the way people think about the estate tax.
Would any of this be possible without the media sort of either going along with it consciously or unconsciously?
Well, it would be possible, but it would be a lot more difficult because of the reach of the media. So you and I can talk to, you know, the people we come into contact with every day, but, you know, that's not very many people, maybe 20 or 30 people a day. Whereas if media or social media starts framing an issue, you know, that can reach thousands or hundreds of thousands of people. So it has a lot bigger chance of having an effect that way.
Is the idea of framing itself, or the idea of framing as you've described it, should we consider that to be a pejorative?
Well, no, not really. I mean, it's just basically a reflection of how people interpret issues. So, for example, in today's news, so we hear a lot about chaos and turmoil surrounding the UK exit vote. You know, that's all framing, but it may very well be chaos and it may be turmoil, and that's just people expressing kind of how they feel about the issues. You know, it's very rare for people to just state facts without saying anything about how they interpret them.
How much power does media have, and do you think that power is growing as we have a more splintered audience for things? People can sort of pick and choose what news they want. Do you think that makes framing more or less effective potentially?
I think it probably makes it more effective, and there's really been a sort of evolution in academic thought about this over the last, 20 or 30 years, where the view today is that mass media, and that includes social media as well now, have a strong impact on what scholars call the social construction of reality. So by framing images of reality, they create sort of a particular and patterned way of seeing things. Now, they've always done that, but now with the rise of social media, the reach and sort of intimate interaction, I guess you would say, with the audience is greater than it's ever been. So media, I would say, is perhaps more powerful than ever.
Steve Corman is director of the Center for Strategic Communication at the Hugh Downs School of Human Communication at ASU. Steve, thanks for the insights. I appreciate the time.
You're welcome. It was my pleasure.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.